You know, that's something we don't think about, right? Making our food not good enough by the white culture. Those of us who are Asian, we look at our food, we're like, oh, I shouldn't eat this and that, because a lot of Asian foods are high in carbohydrates. But what does the white culture tell us? Carbohydrates are bad. So it creates this dilemma of, I don't know what to do. And then you have issues with food.
Yeah. And then at the same time, I just think there are, you know, Asian cultures and other cultures around the world where people have the longest life expectancy. Capitalism, white supremacy cannot have my body. No more. Those systems have done a number on my body. And I am at the point for years now, several years now, that I have been able to say, you can no longer have this body. This is my body. This is my ancestor's body.
In this episode, my dear friend Therese Couture and I talk about the effects of assimilation on our bodies, healing, identity, and more. We also discuss how healing can emerge, being in spaces where we can be in our full humanity and we don't have to be in a state of hypervigilance. If assimilation is a new concept for you, it is often discussed in the context of cultural assimilation when immigrant groups are encouraged to adopt the culture, values, and social behaviors of their host nation. This means shedding hiding aspects of one's culture, including food, clothing, religion, language. Therese is the founder of Embodied Black Girl, a global community that centers the healing and liberation of Black women and femmes and communities of color. Therese and I met in person last year at the advanced level of our somatic experiencing training, but we have been friends, online friends, since 2017, I think 2018. It was so good for my heart to finally meet Therese in person. I hope you enjoy this episode. Good morning, my friend.
Good morning. I'm so happy to be here with you. So happy to see your face.
I'm so happy to have you here. We've had a couple of hiccups, but due to Mother Nature. One time it was snowstorm.
I know, it was such a bad snowstorm. And then it took us forever to even start this because we were chatting away.
Yeah. Welcome. Please introduce yourself, who you are, your ancestry, where you live, what you do.
Thank you. I'm Therese Couture. My pronouns are she, her, hers. Who am I? I am a mama. That's the first thing that comes to mind. I'm a mama. I'm a daughter. I'm a sister. I'm an auntie. I was born in Haiti. I was raised in Brooklyn, New York. And I just think that what's really coming forward is that everything that I do is in service of spirit and my beloved ancestors, and for the healing and liberation of Black women and femmes in particular. But I believe that has a ripple impact on everyone.
So how old were you when you came to Brooklyn?
I was only a few years old. I think I was like 4 or 5 years old at the time.
Did you grow up with a lot of extended family?
I did. We first lived in an apartment and it was like, oh my gosh, so many extended family members in there. And then even after we moved, for my entire life, I have lived in an intergenerational setting. Yeah. So that is definitely a part of my upbringing.
Why did your parents go to New York, go to Brooklyn?
Oh, it's set. Well, my mom, it's a long story. As I have gotten older, what I recognize is that there's a lot of displacement, you know, specifically there's so much that has been done to destabilize Haiti. And so many people are forced to move. Not that they necessarily want to move, but we're seeing this, you know, today with climate change and how that impacts a lot of people in what is considered, quote unquote, the global South in a different way than it impacts folks who are in the, what is considered the global North. But what I've come to see, it's that it's a forced migration, right? It's a forced migration because of the destabilization of the region.
Have you been back to Haiti?
I haven't been. I haven't been back. Every time, again, destabilization. Every time that I was supposed to go back, something occurred. And that's also something that's brought up a lot of grief and also brought up around feelings of belonging and home. And what does that mean? Yeah.
Since we're talking about the feelings of belonging, which is a big topic for me, because a lot of people I know, and myself included, those of us who identify as BIPOC, often there's a, it's a very hard to find a sense of belonging. Because we stand out, right? A lot of us, when we're younger, we try to fit in, not knowing that we would never fully fit in. You know? And it's, I think it's something that you don't recognize until you get older and you stand strong in who you are. Then you go, this is who I am. Accept me for who I am, you know, and I'm proud to stand out. Where do you feel a sense of belonging?
Oh, that's such a loaded question.
We've got time.
Yeah, it's such a loaded question. I kind of want to go back. And I was just thinking about belonging and what you said about the assimilation aspect. And those are, that's like one of the weapons of colonialism and white supremacy. And what I think that many folks who are Black, Indigenous, folks of color, and I include myself in this, is that we don't realize that what one of the things that really roots us is actually the culture that we come from. So we try to assimilate into really something that has no culture, right? It's a form of self-erasure. So for me, the journey has been embracing, reclaiming the parts of myself that I was taught by our overculture, not my family, but taught by our overculture to erase, to dim down, and just, and I think it's just going to be a lifelong journey. What's really helped with belonging for me is recognizing that no matter where I am on earth, that the thing that connects us all is actually the earth.
Ooh.
So the earth, and that it makes me emotional because the earth is our mother. And, or at least that's what I believe, like the mother that nurtures us, that gives us food, that without the earth, like none of us could live. So recognizing that no matter where I am on earth, I belong because I belong to the earth.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And, you know, it breaks my heart what we're doing to earth, to Mother Nature. Yeah. I'm curious, reclaiming parts of yourself, how that looks like, because I know it's different for everyone. I'd love to hear your journey.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like almost I was forced into this journey in many different ways. It started when I was really young, in my very early 20s, when I received a diagnosis and I had to have surgery. And essentially what I was told by my doctor, and I was fortunate to have a great caring doctor at the time, and that this is something that shows up in elderly people, right? This is not something I should be having at this age. And I just had this intuitive knowing sometime after that, that this was linked to the food that I was eating. So although I grew up eating my ancestral foods, grew up in the city, after school, I would hit McDonald's with my friends and all the fast food. And, you know, it was having an impact on my body, right? And this is, and I just want to name that with like certain forms of caution, because some people, that's all they have access to, right? And food is food. I don't want to, like, there's a certain type of morality that we have around food. And I'm also holding that nuance with that, this overculture, this culture that we live in, at least that I live in, it creates certain types of food in order to kill us. Right? Whatever they're making that's full of salt and, you know, all of that, the food is actually created as a weapon as well. So I'm holding those things of like, there are people who live in food deserts, and at the same time, this is their, that could be your only source of food, and recognizing that there are bigger powers at play around what we're putting in our bodies. Yeah. So it started with really going back and changing what I consume. And I was fortunate at the time to be able to do that. That is a privilege, right? And that slowly started to kill my body. That slowly started, I still had to have surgery, so didn't stop the surgery, but all the other things that were happening, it stopped that, right? So going back to my ancestral foods, I think that was the very beginning. And then I think what the things that really shifted it were, number one, when I experienced so much grief when my dad passed away. And my dad is also a survivor of the 2010 earthquake that happened in Haiti. And only a few years after, he passed away. So also me recognizing even that timeline was like another layer of grief. My dad was just a brilliant mathematician. He was an artist. He was also a medicine man. And I remember during his funeral, there was story after story of all the good that he has done and all the lives that he had touched. And I've always been a spiritual person, but it really was almost like a wake-up call for me at the time to embrace more parts of me that I had hidden. So in my work, I was already supporting people in those ways, but that's not what I was leading with publicly. Right? So that's that assimilation piece, right? When, okay, I'm going to hide this part of myself. I will lead with, I will help you build your website, for example, right? But you're like, wait a minute, you get in there, it's something else, right? Or it's something deeper. And then within not long after my dad passed away, experiencing in the span of like a few years, experiencing state violence, medical violence, those things brought me even more further back, further into reclaiming who I was, because actually I had to reclaim my body, because that's what these systems want.
Yeah. Reclaiming your body. Oh, that just hit me in my heart, because for so many of us, when we assimilate, that's one of the first things we give up.
Yeah.
Without knowing it, you know?
Without knowing it.
And I also want to name that when we assimilate, we are made to feel so guilty about our ancestral food.
Mm.
Right? It smells.
Can't bring it to school.
Yeah, can't bring it to school. It smells. Oh, you shouldn't eat this. For me, for example, one of my ancestral foods is rice, white rice. But how long? What does the fitness wellness industry tell us about it? Oh, don't eat it. High in sugar, high in carbohydrates. And then it's like, okay, if you don't eat it, then what do you turn to? You know, what other foods do you turn to? And you say this so well, is that then you start to eat food that are no good for your body, not good for your system. For me, when I reclaim that part of it, eating my ancestry foods again, my digestive system was so much happier.
Mm, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I gave up white rice for a few years and went to quinoa. My digestive system was like, what is this? I'm like, oh, it's fine. It's healthier. But my body was so unhappy. What are some of your ancestry foods that you love, that you enjoy?
Oh, rice and beans. Rice and beans, definitely one of the ancestral foods. On the first of January, New Year, is the celebration of the independence, Haitian Independence Day, and everyone eats soup jumeau, what they call soup jumeau, which is a form of squash that I love. We make it throughout the year, but it's just like on that day, everyone who has that ancestry, that lineage, eats that food. And then depending on the time of year, there's like a whole bunch of different foods that you eat depending on what time of year. But it's really seasonal, right? It really also is seasonal what you eat. But those are some of my favorites. I love soups. I just had soup actually just before. It wasn't that soup, but I love soups. And the same thing here. That's the other part, because when I was talking about the foods that, you know, not wanting to moralize food, but I'm like, McDonald's is not the same as like our ancestral foods of like white rice that they try to demonize. I know that for years they would say kale. Oh my God, everyone has to eat kale. And people were switching from eating collard greens to eating kale when collard greens are just as nutritious.
Yeah.
You know, we're always making collard greens also in the house too. But it's just as nutritious. But the other part is like the foods that folks who are Black, Indigenous, and people of color eat, those are the foods that get demonized. Those are the foods that are supposedly always unhealthy, that you shouldn't eat. The list goes on.
Well, and then you take into consideration eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite rampant in the Asian culture, not talked about, but it is quite rampant, especially the young people. And especially those who have immigrated here. Because then it's like, oh, you shouldn't eat this, da, 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 da. And then it becomes a lot of them are like, oh, then they're restricting eating. You know, that's something we don't think about, right? Making our food not good enough by the white culture. Those of us who are Asian, we look at our food, we're like, oh, I shouldn't eat this and that. Because a lot of Asian foods are high in carbohydrates. But what does the white culture tell us? Carbohydrates are bad. So it creates this dilemma of, I don't know what to do. And then you have issues with food.
Yeah. And then at the same time, I just think there are, you know, Asian cultures and other cultures around the world where people have the longest life expectancy. Right? So it's like, okay, so why isn't that they're eating white rice and they're fine? It's like, that's not taken into consideration. And we also have to go and talk about, of course, the research bias. Right?
Oh, yes.
Any research that comes out, it's typically research around white folks, most likely white male. If it's not white male, maybe, you know, there might be a few white female, but how many of even what is considered research includes folks of color, right? Black, indigenous, and folks of color.
Not many. This was surprising to me. But I guess maybe I shouldn't be surprised because my husband, side note, always said to me, one of my flaws is that I expect the best of people. So I was having a conversation with a white friend the other day about how harmful the body mass index is, the BMI. Mm-hmm. And this friend was like, but why? I'm like, because it was designed. The research group was white men, white people. It doesn't take into account folks of color. You know, and now most of us know that the BMI is a horrible tool, you know, but I was surprised that a lot of people still don't know. And then when you go to the doctor, person of color, and they use the BMI on you, suddenly you're obese when you think, oh, I'm okay.
Yeah.
Right. Because according to the BMI, I'm obese.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it was like, okay, no, let me just take that tool, throw it out of window.
Wow. 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 And then we internalize it and then make decisions and choices based on that. And then if we have children, how that creates this ripple impact within our homes, within, you know, other people that that we interact with. If we have clients, how that create harm. And I'm just thinking about this, and I was just thinking about this actually over the weekend, that when I was pregnant with my son, I remember going to the OBGYN for, you know, my routine exam. And I remember the woman who was my doctor at the time was really obsessed with her weight, to the point where literally the entire appointment, she was talking about being on Weight Watchers in one breath, like talking about being on Weight Watchers. You'd see all like the different, you know, packages, drinks on her desk and things like that. And then in the next breath, she literally projected that onto me and was like, oh my God, you have gained too much weight during the pregnancy. You have done this, this, and that, and that. And then she ordered a series of tests. By the time that I was leaving that office, I was in tears because she was convinced that I had, what is the diabetes?
Gestational diabetes, yeah.
Right. She was convinced. And I knew in my body, I was like, no, I don't. No, I don't. However, I went and took the test. Even I was like in tears. And of course, what did the test show? I didn't have anything, right? I did not have. And she was shocked. I ended up leaving that doctor.
Oh,
but this is some of the violence that happened. It was an unnecessary test where I had to drink unnecessary, you know, chemicals, essentially. Yep. They say it's safe, but had to drink these unnecessary chemicals in order to do this test.
Before I became a therapist, I was in Chinese medicine for 14 years. So a lot of my practice was treating fertility and hormones for women. And the number of, I don't know if you know this, so gestational diabetes is common in Asian women when they're pregnant. Just one of those things is in our genetics. And so many of my clients who came in who are Asian, when they're pregnant, have that gestational diabetes. But same thing as what your doctor did was to make them feel guilty about it.
Ooh.
You had too much sugar. You got to stop drinking your iced tea. You got to stop eating rice. You got to stop eating beans because they're all high in sugar. But there was no recognition that, okay, perhaps these are the things you need to be doing, but no recognition that it's not your fault.
Mm.
It's genetics. And then it's so toxic. Like you walk out of the appointment going, what did I do wrong?
Yeah. I mean, I was in tears.
Yeah.
I was so in tears and so upset during that appointment. And this is this white woman literally projecting her own issues, right? Which, of course, are from the overculture, but given the power dynamics within that room and that space, projecting it onto me, right? And that having an impact not only on me, but also on the baby that I'm carrying.
Yeah, I'm so sorry that happened to you. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that just makes me angry. You know?
I know.
And I read somewhere, I can't remember, but the advice for folks of color, especially women of color now, is when you go and see a doctor, bring someone else with whatever is more, especially for serious things, because then you have a friend to advocate for you in the room. So you don't have to, because then you don't have to deal with it on your own. Because oftentimes when you go see the doctor, if you're there for something even remotely like serious, many people kind of zone out. Because
yeah, if you go into freeze, right?
You go into freeze. So they are like, if you bring a friend, at least they can be there and ask questions.
Yeah. And I think at the time, it just felt out of left field because I wasn't there alone.
You're not.
I wasn't. It just came out of left field. And I think what happened, we actually both were in shock. It was like a level of shock. And I think there also needs to be conversations before going in, because you can bring someone and it's like almost like role playing scenarios to be like, okay, if this comes up, this is, but then at the time, this was, you know, this is the first time this is happening to me. So I didn't know that this was going to come up. Right. So I didn't even have this framework to like prepare for. And at that time in my life, I was disconnected in many sense from community because I was living on the opposite coast from where I grew up. So there's so many factors at play. When things like that happen. And it's like that power they put on, you know, if it's a doctor, the white coat, or just like the doctor, there's a certain power dynamic that happens in those rooms. And I think I'm also thinking about how those power dynamics also extend into child protective services too. Right? Because if a doctor believes that you are potentially harming a fetus or harming your child, they could report you. The tentacles go really far.
the extra steps we have to take to protect ourselves, right? In one of the podcast episodes, I interviewed one of my teachers from grad school, and she's a Black woman who lives in the South, and she's been in the field for a very long time, and I love talking to her. One of the things she said was when she first started practicing, she quickly realized that her supervisor, who was white, didn't get it and wanted to call social services or the police when she shared what the mother did or what the mother had said to the children. Mm. And then my teacher was like, but that is part of the culture. For so long, those of us who, you know, especially if we try to assimilate, we think, oh, there's only one way to do things, which is the white patriarchy way. And then as you take a step back and you start to reclaim yourself, you think, no, no, our culture have our own way of doing things, right? Mm-hmm. And if, you know, if harm is happening, then as a community, because those of us who grew up in collectivist culture, then as a community, let's take a look at not just call in the powers to fix something that the community can be there for each other and look up to each other.
And that is, you know, that is racism, because they wouldn't call CPS, you know, here, I don't know what they call it in Canada, but Child Protective Services that they call here, they wouldn't call that on a white mother. It's the dehumanization of folks who are Black and folks who are brown, folks of color, folks who are in different classes, right, who are working class. And who's, it's almost like you shouldn't even have a child, right? It's almost like that. That's the sense that I get, but it's that the way the violence gets perpetrated, right? Because I'm just thinking in that situation that I was in, it can escalate in many ways, right? There's many ways that it can escalate. God forbid, okay, you're like, no, I'm not going to do this exam. I'm not going to do this. And then it turns out you do, that I did have gestational diabetes. And then that had an impact on the child. Like, there's many, many, many avenues that it can really spiral out of control. I'm just thinking about, I forget her name, but there was this mother, this Black mother and her partner whose child was taken away. This is like a common story. I believe they were in Florida at the time, and her son was taken away because of what a doctor believed, that he was underweight, right? Because he was underweight. So these folks who end up being agents of the state, that's really what it is. Like, they end up being agents of the state who then inflict violence.
Yeah, here it's a lot of talk about the doctors mistreating, especially the indigenous folks, because they have this assumption that indigenous folks drinks and do drugs more than the other folks of color. There was a story a few years ago about this grandfather and his granddaughter who went to the bank. The bank called the cops on them because they assumed that the grandfather was drunk. When he asked for something, and the staff at the bank just assumed, made an assumption and called the police. And he got put in jail. He got arrested. And then this whole thing made it to the news, and then the bank had to apologize for, and then they're like, oh, we're going to do diversity training.
Yeah. And I just think about when you even think, you know, I also think about the violence that is perpetrated by bringing in drugs, right? Substances, alcohol into certain communities. and then denying healthcare, denying education, denying basic rights, like inflicting the trauma and then bringing in substances that essentially help people cope. Mm-hmm. And then being like, wait a minute. Wait a minute. We're going to now stereotype you as, okay, these are the folks who are quote unquote on drugs, right? And here, you know, the war on drugs. What was the war on drugs and the roots of that? It's so violent. Oh my gosh.
So violent and so heartbreaking, because then with everything we say, and then it was like, oh, you guys are at fault. You guys don't know what you're doing. You guys are not doing better. But then as to what you say, you're not giving them the resources to do it either. And if you give them the resources, you want them to do it your way. Mm-hmm. But your way doesn't work in a collectivist culture. Mm-hmm. And that is often not taken into consideration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's individualist, right? It's individualist. It's so disconnected from the earth. Like going back to like, it's disconnected from the earth. And I think the collectivist culture that we both grew up in, there's a deep connection to the earth. There's a deep connection that this is the earth that sustains us. We are in relationship with the earth.
And in my culture, there's a lot of connection to the moon cycle too, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The lunar calendar. And
that's how you plant. Like my mom, that's how you would plant. That's how you, even like to the point of like, that's how you would even take care of your hair.
Ooh, tell me more about that.
Okay, if you want your hair to grow, you would wait until the new moon to do a certain ritual, to trim your hair. You wait until the new moon. Like that's one of them.
And now when we were talking about food just now in the Chinese culture, is very much this food that you eat will help you to do this. So when you're talking about hair, it's like, oh, if you eat this food, it will help your hair become more luscious and black and you won't get gray hair as early. You know, and it's all connected, right? Like you say, and then where do we get our food? We get our food from Mother Earth, from the rain, from the sun. And if we can tap into that, then that connection to self, that reclaiming ourselves and our body is so much, not easier, but easier, I think.
Yeah, it's literally, I was leading a group recently, and I was just saying, it's really about one of the things I've had to say to myself over the years is that capitalism, white supremacy cannot have my body. No more. Those systems have done a number on my body. And I am at the point for years now, several years now, that I have been able to say, you can no longer have this body. This is my body. This is my ancestor's body.
Yeah. And in the Western individual culture, especially for women, the body is not yours. That's what so many of us were taught.
It's not yours.
And if we get political, look at what's happening in the courts in the States. They're taking away women's rights to make decisions about their body. And that just has generations of impact that they're not thinking about.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting because with what has happened recently with IVF, now you see that some of folks who are on the conservative end of things because now that's impacting them. They're starting to talk about it. And what really, really is like, I'm like, can you just not get it? Our freedom is intertwined. There is no freedom until everyone is free.
Yes.
So I can't remember the quote, but that quote that goes like, they're essentially, it's like they'll knock on your door one day. They're going to come for you one day.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to impact you one day.
Mm-hmm.
It may not be today, but it's coming. And it's really, it just stems, I think, just from that individual, like it's about me. And the sad part, I really don't think folks who think like that are really happy, right? I don't think they're happy. I think I don't even want to go into it, but there's
a lot. Just take it out.
We're going to go down a different rabbit hole.
We'll have you back and go down that rabbit hole in another episode, but.
It's like, no, it's going to come for you. It's going to come for you. And you should have seen that. So, and the other thing is that working with clients that are also outside of the United States, the diaspora that's outside of the United States, who share with me that in places like the Caribbean, and other parts of the world looks to what is happening in the Western context, the US context, that impacts their laws, right? That impacts, you know, what they're able to do in their work as well, in having justice and equal rights for women, for LGBTQIA plus folks. It impacts their work too, and their lives too. And I just think about, just recently I read about how in Ghana, how they're essentially saying that if you are someone who's LGBTQIA plus, you can be put to death. You can literally be put to death. But when you look at it deeper, it is the law is rooted from white religious fundamentalists that are based in the United States. Like, these are the folks that are actually impacting what is happening in all the way in Ghana and Africa. Right? It's so upsetting. It's really upsetting because it's making folks who already are face so much oppression and marginalization in so many ways, it's making life harder. It's adding layers of trauma. And I know both of us, we work in helping to hopefully alleviate, maybe even transform, shift that. But it gets really difficult because of the systems and these laws that are being put into place that are making who you love illegal, making your body illegal, making it harder to get access to healthcare.
Yeah, and a lot of my clients are women of color. And I'll say to them, when they bring up these topics that you just mentioned, right? Systemic racism, oppression, and I say to them, I don't have the magic answer.
Yeah.
I can be here for you. I can hear, I can witness, I can listen. And I wish I have the answer. I wish I can help you to move forward from this. But the reality is we need to acknowledge that the system is there and is harming us. Because acknowledgement is a part of healing. And then let's look at other things that we can help you to heal. Because that isn't going to change tomorrow. All this systemic oppression, systemic racism, capitalism, you know, white supremacy, that's not going to change tomorrow. I also don't know whether it's going to change in our lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, you and I, we do the work and we uplift the voices of those in need. And then we look at other areas and goes, okay, how can I help? What else can I do? I would love to talk about your global community, Embodied Black Girls.
Yeah, it's such a sweet space to be in because it's a place where I feel not only, you know, folks share that it's a place where they're able to land, but it's a place I'm able to land over and over again. And it just reminds me of the importance of having spaces that are for Black women and femmes and women and femmes of color. And the conversations that we're able to have, it's, again, it's not about having all the answers. And I know for some people, they're like, I need an answer. Please, you must give me an answer because I'm in so much pain and there has to be an answer to this pain. And like you, I don't necessarily have all the answers. However, I feel that the answers can emerge from being in spaces where we're able to be in our full humanity. The healing can emerge in being in spaces where we can be in our full humanity, that we don't have to be in a state of hypervigilance and constantly scanning and looking for threat. That we can breathe, right? We can just take a moment and breathe. And that's not to say that it's perfect, right? I've been fortunate in the sense of like, there hasn't been these conflicts and these things that have happened. However, I do want to name that being in community for many of us, or trying to be in community, trying to be, or practicing, I like thinking of it as practicing, can be really hard, right? Can be really hard because I think on one level is that back to assimilation, we've been taught our bodies, we have this embodied response of when, for example, when Black folks are together, oh my God, this is dangerous. Right? It's dangerous because literally what would happen, what has happened historically is that those spaces have been monitored, those spaces by the government, right? Those spaces have been infiltrated. So there can be something within people's system, and also people have experienced interpersonal harm, right? Been like, oh, it's another person, another Black person that hurt me, right? So there has been also layers of interpersonal harm. And at the same time, I really do believe it's in being together in these types of spaces that we can find healing, but also access leadership. And hopefully collectively begin to create something different, right? To impact even the systems. Cause I have, you know, I work with folks who work within these systems, right? Who have organizations so they're doing work. So within them, within these systems. So if that change can happen, within, of course, the body, and then within other bodies, how that can have a ripple of impact, And also recognizing it's not happening fast enough. It feels like it's not happening fast enough, but it's happening.
Mm. That's beautiful. I'm so glad you're doing this work.
Yes.
If you do have a magic wand, how would you want the world to look like for your children?
The first thing that when you said that, if you had a magic wand, and I was like, I do have a magic wand. I was like, I do have a magic wand. And that magic wand, I believe, is our bodies. But to answer your question, because it's such a juicy question, I would want them to have an embodied sense of freedom, of liberation. I'm like thinking about my little one to really feel, to know where he comes from and who he comes from and what he comes from. And to have a firm understanding of the present moment, whatever that present moment is at the time, and to also be connected to the future, what is to come, and to be connected to community, to be connected to the earth, to be connected to the cosmos, to the higher self, to God, to really be able to be in a relational space. If the world can like snap our fingers, get on the same page, let's get into deep relationship with one another. Relationship that is honoring, that is reverential, that recognizes the sacredness of life. My little one said to me the other day, everyone has a mother. So everyone, trying to say like everyone has a mother and therefore is loved unconditionally because they have a mother. Like there's someone who loves them so much. And I know that's not the experience for necessarily everyone. But I like to believe that we all come from love. Right? Regardless of the circumstance of how we were born and what that may look like for all of us, but at the source, we come from love. We come from that seed of life wanting to just burst forward. Mm-hmm. Life wanting to like burst forward, to spring into being. And that's what we come from. And I think that's love.
That's beautiful. As you're sharing that, I'm like, for those who feels like they didn't come from love, if they didn't have a great childhood, but to be able to take that, what you just sharing goes, maybe love doesn't mean your parents, you know, love from spirit, from universe, from Mother Earth, that maybe can help with the healing process.
Mm-hmm.
The next question is for fun. If you could spend a day with someone, deceased or alive, who would it be?
Oh my gosh. Who would it be? I was thinking, at first I was thinking Maya Angelou or Toni Morrison, who I have, both of them I've like adored since I was like a little girl. I would totally want to spend a day with either one of them. Yeah.
Well, let's say you could spend a day with two of them. Is there like a burning question you would ask them?
The question that's coming, like that's, I guess, formulating is the question around how do you root to freedom in spite of the system? How do you root? How, you know, just their, I would just love to hear their individual stories of like how do you root to freedom? How do you root to love in spite of or despite? Because there's so much happening in the world right now. And one of the things that has really been just on my heart is, despite the genocide that's happening of the Palestinian people, seeing folks get married. I watched a wedding and I was like, wow. To me, that's resistance, but it's deeper than resistance, because I feel like for folks of color, for Indigenous folks, for Black folks, our lives are more than just resistance. And I think it goes back to, it's like something deeper wants to burst forward. So I don't know if that answered your question, but
yeah. I think it did. And it's a beautiful answer. And the reminder to, when you're doing social justice work, resistance work, that you don't forget to also hold joy, to allow yourself to experience joy. You know? Go ahead.
The last thing I'll say, I'm like, I just think that is how, for so many of us, our ancestors survived. I remember growing up, so much laughter. I mean, there's so much laughter in our house. It was just like, literally, you would think you're at a comedy show. I mean, the other thing, my dad was like the funniest, one of the funniest people, and could tell the most amazing stories. And you'd think you're at a comedy show. So much laughter all the time.
It's interesting, right? Because without my family, we were so, one of the generational trauma with my family, and I think for some immigrants, is we were so caught up in the suffering.
Mm.
You must work hard. You must suffer. And because you suffer, then you will have great achievement. So not knowing how to hold joy and pain at the same time. This is one of my biggest lesson, to remember that on the bad days, you can also see joy. And I love that in your family, you all embrace that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you miss your dad's laughter?
I do, but I can literally go back to it and just like recall it.
Yeah.
I can recall it really easily, but I do miss him, like in the physical form. I miss him. And I was just thinking the other day, oh my God, I wish I could give him a hug and just feel his hug, right? Yeah.
Thank you, my friend.
Oh, thank you so much. This was so, so sweet. Thank you for having me, for inviting me. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. This week's advice from your Chinese auntie, Yi, that's me, is if you're an immigrant like myself and you realize that you have given up a lot of your culture in order to fit in, it's not too late to start and embrace your culture. Start with food. What do your ancestors eat? Try that again. So maybe think about what your grandparents or great-grandparents used to do. Maybe they read poetry. That is something that you can start dabbing into. Whatever it is, if you are constantly trying to fit in and find a sense of belonging, I hope you reach out to members of your community and find a sense of home there.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Conversations with Your Chinese Auntie podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please feel free to rate, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you listen to your podcasts. That helps others find the show, and we greatly appreciate it. Also, remember to sign up for our newsletter to receive free materials and updates. Links in the website, patriciapeterson.ca. That's PatriciaPeterson.ca. Again, thanks for listening. We hope you have a great week, and we'll see you in the next episode.